an ominous warning from a new UN climate report.
We are teetering on a planetary tightrope. Either leaders bridge the emissions gap, or we plunge headlong into climate disaster.
What it means for life on Earth.
It means more intense storms, more intense rainfall and storms especially. So for every degree of warming, you increase the intensity of rainfall on average by something like 7%.
Today is Thursday, October 24th, and this is The Issue from VOA. I'm Scott Walterman.
And I'm Lori London.
Current policies are taking us towards a catastrophic 3.1 degrees Celsius temperature rise by the end of the century.
The United Nations has released a report that says if immediate action is not taken to reduce carbon emissions, the world will face catastrophic climate change. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres says it has already started.
Around the world, people are paying a terrible price. Record emissions mean record sea temperatures supercharging monster hurricanes. Record heat is turning forests into tinder boxes and cities into saunas. Record rains are resulting in biblical floods.
Johan Rockström is the director of the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research.
It is a dark moment.
Governments in 2015 signed up to the Paris Agreement and a cap of 1.5 Celsius warming to prevent a cascade of dangerous impacts. But Rockström says we're not making things better. We're making them worse.
We're not making progress. Actually, we are making things more and more high risk, potentially even unmanageable for humanity.
Now, nations will gather next month at the annual United Nations Climate Summit. They call it COP29. It'll be held in Azerbaijan, where they will work to build on an agreement made last year to move away from fossil fuels.
It requires, to begin with, that the global emission of greenhouse gases are reduced by 7.5% per year between now and 2030, so that we cut global emissions by half by 2030 compared to 2019.
It's interesting, Scott, because it seems like every year these climate summits seem so, you know, motivating and so ready, and the sense of urgency is there. And yet, here we are every year getting worse.
Well, you know, a couple of days ago, we interviewed a climate scientist, and she said, or she was habitat scientist, and she said, oh, you know, the politicians have to do the right thing and stand up to the thing and, you know, logic thing. And my point was then and is now, yes, logically understood, but it's not logic, it's courage. Courage to stand up and do what they're being asked to do, because they have constituents that don't believe this is happening.
Right. And you know, there's the financial impact, but I think that it's like pay now or pay later, basically, as far as it looks to me. From what we're hearing, you know, the cost of climate change and all the what happens after these catastrophes.
No, well, you can see it in the Carolinas from the last hurricane in the southeastern United States. The amount of money that's going to be spent in Florida and Georgia and North Carolina and Tennessee to repair the damage from the super hurricane is
right,
real
and not
money
just here. And not just here, it's all over the world, and
globally.
And a lot of these places, they don't have even the, you know, the kind of finances that the United States, which is one of the, or if not the biggest greenhouse gas emitter, they don't have the resources to rebuild. All right, well, let's dig deeper into this. Joining us on where we are and where we may be headed is Tapio Schneider, Professor of Environmental Science and Engineering at the California Institute of Technology.
So thank you so much for being able to talk to us.
Thank you for having me.
So this new UN report is out, and instead of talking about numbers and goals, because it doesn't seem to have an impact in the general population, if the Earth goes 3 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial times, what does the Earth, the weather, the climate look like to us?
I mean, first of all, 3 degrees Celsius in the global mean is not 3 degrees Celsius everywhere. It will be considerably more over land and in general, much more over high latitudes, say in Canada and in Alaska, for example, and Northern Europe. 3 degrees warming will be probably about twice as much on average, could be 6 degrees in those regions. And it's somewhere 4 or 5 degrees or so over land, warmer, depending on where exactly you are. And of course, an immediate effect is more intense heat waves. You're just shifting temperature up. So every heat wave will be more intense than it currently is by that mean shift placed. It means more intense storms, more intense rainfall and storms especially. So for every degree warming, you increase the intensity of rainfall on average by something like 7%. So this will be like a 20% increase in the intensity of rainfall on average for 3 degrees warming, but more over land regions where the warming is stronger. So hurricanes like the ones we've just seen producing extreme rainfall, that will become much more frequent.
It sounds to me like they're basically saying we are on this path and there is no more time, that these governments have promised things, you know, to curb emissions and they're not doing it. And it sounds like it's getting worse. What are we looking at as far as a timeline for this planet and habitability?
Yeah, I mean, Earth will remain habitable, right? That's just to be clear. It's not that animals or humans will go extinct, but it has severe impacts on human populations, especially in places that are already stressed by climate conditions, especially in places that are low-lying near sea level. Sea level will obviously rise just by thermal expansion of the oceans alone to stay below even the 2 degree warming above pre-industrial times, and extremely drastic emissions to stay below 1.5 degrees. In fact, so drastic that I think there's no realistic way to stay below 1.5 degrees warming. It's important to keep in mind, though, that these temperature thresholds are somewhat arbitrary. It is not that if it exceeds 1.5 degree, this or that drastic thing happens, or after 2 degrees, the next drastic thing happens. We need to avoid every bit of warming we can avoid, and that still needs to be our goal. So, say, even if we overshoot to 2 degrees, which may well happen, I would say is likely to happen, we should still make every effort we can to stay, say, below the 3 degrees, which is the current policy warming. I hope 3 degrees we will not reach. I don't know where in this range of temperatures climate will equilibrate. For climate to equilibrate, we need to reduce emissions to net zero. That's a huge lift, but that's achievable over time scales of the next few decades. What is not achievable is, say, achieving a 50% emission reduction in the next 6 or 7 years, which is what you would need to stay below 1.5, or within the next decade to stay below 2 degrees warming. But we need to reduce emissions. We cannot give up on that to avoid every bit of warming we can avoid.
How do you do that? So the top 20, the G20 countries, are responsible for most of the emissions. And the will to do what they have to do is simply not there.
Yeah, I mean, I think I would say it's not just, of course, it takes will, but more the will you need is mostly to shape policies that incentivize rapid technological evolution. I mean, obviously what we need is replace energy production, electricity production by burning off fossil fuels by renewable sources. We need to electrify everything. And we need to find ways of producing electricity cheaply and efficiently from renewables, photovoltaics, forms of solar power, wind power, perhaps nuclear power. I mean, technologically, we know what it takes and it can be done. It is just a massive reshaping of our energy infrastructure, which has evolved over essentially a century. And it's not so easy to completely change that overnight. It will just take time to build the grid infrastructure, the storage infrastructure, if a large fraction of the energy comes from, say, solar power that we only get during daylight, and the production infrastructure. A typical power plant lasts a few decades. You're unlikely to shift them all off overnight and replace them by something else. It will just take time. And where it takes will is the political will to incentivize that transition for it to happen as fast as we can make it happen.
Right. And the big climate conference is coming up next month. Already the stated goals are not being met. And it sort of reminds me a bit, and it's probably a bad equation. I don't mean it that way. But, you know, these agreements just sound kind of like elusive, like peace talked in the Middle East, because they sound motivated and they have great ambition, but there's nothing binding. Is there another way to, you know, make things move at pace that they need to be going?
Yeah, I think the analogy with the Middle East, I hope, falls a bit short, is that at least here we know what needs to be done. We know what technologies we need to develop further and deploy at scale. What the solution looks like, I think, is relatively clear. What do we need to accelerate getting there? I would say in the U.S., the Inflation Reduction Act is actually a good example. It is quite effective in incentivizing policy change to technological change, mostly by providing positive incentives for the changes that we want to see, as opposed to, say, penalizing emissions of CO2, which would be another approach that would be favored by many economists, but has turned out to be hard to implement, carbon taxes and the like. I think we need these kinds of policies and more of those, and worldwide, at least in the G20.
Talk about when you mention the Inflation Reduction Act and the things that they've done to incentivize the production of clean energy. Give us some specific examples.
Yeah, I mean, there's a broad basket of examples. For example, incentivizing electrification of households, improved energy efficiency of buildings. That's a large and in some ways no regrets area, where you end up with more comfortable buildings if you insulate them better and you save a lot of energy. And there are many such things that we know we can do. And it just requires, you know, some incentives to get over the hump to get them done.
What about the world's food systems, agriculture? What role does that play, and why don't we hear more of that?
Yeah, but the agriculture sector does contribute to greenhouse gas emissions. For example, the efficiency of the agricultural sector has increased tremendously in the last 50 years, the Green Revolution, primarily because of the wide deployment of nitrogen fertilizers. Nitrogen fertilizers, however, are produced from natural gas as the feedstocks through the Haber-Bosch method. So it leads to greenhouse gas emissions all in itself. And that's, I think, one good example of where a large fraction of the world's population, the well-being of the world's population, depends very strongly on, for example, nitrogen fertilizers, where right now we have no good replacement for the production of them that does not result in greenhouse gas emissions. And what it takes there to make progress is advances in chemical engineering that allow us to produce nitrogen fertilizers, for example, without emitting greenhouse gases. And there's a lot of research underway. At the same time, this is a very large industry. And again, like, you don't change industries overnight. There's a few easy things, I think, in food systems, or relatively easy things that one could do. I mean, for example, in the U.S., not quite sure about the exact fraction, but it might be close to 30% or so of food just ends up going to waste. It's just simply food waste. Actually, reduction of food waste is something that one could achieve with relatively few regrets and would have an immediate beneficial impact.
So would you say you're optimistic about the climate future?
I'm optimistic that we'll find a way to a stable climate, meaning that temperatures will stop increasing. I don't quite know at which level temperatures will equilibrate. I do hope it will be less than 3 degrees. But where exactly we land, well, it depends, A, on all these problems we have talked about, technological changes and so forth. There's actually a wild card in there as well, which is that as we reduce emissions from greenhouse gases that cause global warming, an ancillary benefit of doing that is that we get cleaner air. And that's something we should all, of course, hope for. Air pollution right now kills around, or leads to premature death of about 8 million people a year. So cleaner air is an unambiguously good thing. But right now, the air pollution we are living with has a side effect of also cooling climate, meaning it masks some global warming by altering clouds, by reflecting sunlight directly. We don't quite know how large that cooling effect is. So there's a wild card in how much warming we get is that as we reduce emissions, we'll get some extra warming from having cleaner air. And while cleaner air is desirable, the extra warming is not. And how large that extra warming is, we do not quite know. There's a large uncertainty in that number. And you know, that can push us, I mean, certainly above the 1.5 degree target, I would say, but it might give us a few tenths of a degree, several tenths of a degree extra warming. And how large that is, I think will play a crucial role in where we'll eventually equilibrate, at what temperature above pre-industrial times we'll eventually equilibrate.
Do you think that these reports and some of the comments from the UN and other scientists when they say climate catastrophe, is that alarmist or is that realistic?
I mean, if you're in North Carolina and your house gets destroyed by intense rainfall from a hurricane, I mean, that's obviously catastrophic. And climate change is already leading and will lead to more extreme events, each one of which will be catastrophic for some part of the world population. I think it's justified to talk about catastrophes whose probability is increasing because of global warming. I think there's a subtext to your question. Does it help to say that or not in the public discourse? I don't know the answer to that. I think you're currently focusing a lot on the policy questions and what people think. But I think maybe what I want to emphasize and where I derive some optimism from is ultimately a lot of these questions are technology questions. And the technology is advancing irrespective of the political process. For example, the cost of producing electricity from solar power has decreased by 90%. Yeah, by about 90% over the last decade plus. There is a point at which it's cheaper to produce energy from renewables. And that point is already reached, say, for electricity production in many parts of the world. And at that point, it's obviously economically advantageous to use renewables, irrespective of policy. And I think we'll reach that point. Now, what policy can do is get us there faster. But I think I derive some optimism from the fact that all indications are that we will get to the point that we'll stabilize the climate.
All right. I'll take the optimism. Thanks so much for the perspective.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Tapio Schneider, Professor of Environmental Science and Engineering at the California Institute of Technology.
You know, Lori, I got to be honest. That was much less gloom and doom than I anticipated.
Absolutely. I mean, all of the world leaders and the international climate scientists are sounding such alarm. And I mean, we can see it with species disappearing and these storms getting worse and worse, but it's nice to hear that perspective, at least that there's some hope. So yeah, I agree. It was actually nice to hear that optimism and feel a little bit of hope here.
It actually kind of makes sense what he's saying. You know, money talks, you know what walks. And when you make it an economic incentive and you turn that corner where the good energy is cheaper than the bad energy, everybody will start moving to the good energy. It makes sense.
I mean, exactly. And you know, like the numbers are there when you start adding up the cost of these disasters to rebuild and to clean up and people being relocated. And it's just completely makes sense.
You've been listening to The Issue on The Voice of America.
On behalf of all of us here at VOA, thanks so much for joining us.
Follow us on X and Facebook at VOA The Issue. And you can get news 24 hours a day, 7 days a week on our website, voanews.com.
In Washington, I'm Lori London.
And I'm Scott Walterman.
We'll see you tomorrow.